Okay, so today, I'm going to talk about the emptiness of self and why it matters. So in Zen, we say the self is empty or doesn't exist in the way we usually conceive of it. So this teaching may sometimes seem a little abstract or philosophical, perhaps even a little depressing or disorienting. And why does it matter? So, in summary, I'll give you the answer right off so that you want to listen. Knowing the true nature of ourself is exactly what liberates us from fear and suffering. So I'm going to give a brief, hopefully brief, overview of the Buddhist teachings on the emptiness of self, and then explore what they mean in our daily life and practice, and why they're helpful, why they are meaningful. So the Buddha didn't actually teach that the self is empty, or that the self doesn't exist. He actually wholeheartedly discouraged any speculation whatsoever on the nature of self. What he taught was anatta, or not self. So he taught a practice of recognizing each and every aspect of our experience, everything we encounter, as not self, or refraining from identifying anything as self. This is an extremely pragmatic teaching. He wasn't saying that I had this great insight when I was on the enlightenment seat about what self is really like. What he did was observe when we do this, when we identify something as self, it leads to suffering. What if you don't do that? If you don't identify something as self, it doesn't lead to suffering. So he just says, all right. Then I recommend you just don't identify anything as self. And that included not just like obvious attachments to possessions or pleasure or status or anything like that. He meant don't even identify as self the core things that make up a human being. Don't even identify as self your body or your sensations, your perceptions, your thoughts, your volition, your consciousness. Don't even identify that as self. And when he talked about emptiness or shunyata, he talked about it as a mode of experience in which you refrain from adding anything to your experience. So we're adding that sense of I. He called it I, me, and my making. If we're not doing that, then we're have this kind of mode of perception, which he called shunyata. So later on in Buddhism, in the Mahayana, we started talking more about the true nature of self. We called about the our true self nature is no self nature. So it's the same, but to some extent, we are celebrating the empty self, empty things. Celebrate the liberated self, which functions beautifully when we actually understand and recognize its empty nature. So when we say the self is empty, we mean it's empty of any inherent, enduring, independent nature. It's empty of something we expect to be there, like a glass is empty of water. You have a glass, it suggests there should be some kind of liquid in it. So when we say it's empty, we're referring to like the corresponding situation where there's something in there. So similarly, we say the self is empty because most of the time we project or assume that there's something in there. There's some kind of inherent nature in there. Nevertheless, although the self is empty, we function. We speak. We make choices. We go about our day. We have spiritual practice. Everything still unfolds. And so in Mahayana, we call this suchness. this is, things are empty, but they are just as they are. So this is an example of the celebration of empty things, empty life, from my favorite, Hongzhi. He said, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all of the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So I would say that the original Buddhists emphasized that if you refrain from identifying things as self, you relieve suffering. And I mean, they sometimes described a little bit about nirvana, but there wasn't this celebration of if you awaken to the emptiness of self, you can wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So there's a positivity here in Mahayana, but the Theravadins warn against this kind of teaching for good reason, because then we conceive of emptiness or suchness as a thing. So we want to remember that all of these are tools to get us to let go of our fixed ideas, as opposed to, they're not metaphysical speculation. So getting into the practical, how do we practice with emptiness? And I would say there's three aspects to this, three steps, if you will. First, to just expose ourselves to the teaching. So I have a podcast episode on just wrestling with the teachings. You don't have to understand them. You don't have to necessarily like them or be attracted to them. But that's part of our practice, is just to expose ourselves to the teaching. And it's not like you have to have a massive list of teachings. You have to expose yourself to every single one, but we just keep up this effort to expose ourselves to new teachings, especially those on the emptiness of self. And this isn't to accumulate new ideas, but to challenge the ideas we already have, especially the ones we don't even know we have. So that's why it's worth wrestling with the teachings, even if they at first aren't obviously useful, or they aren't that attractive or intuitive. Then we meditate. And I think our practice of Zazen or really any deep meditative practice is about enacting this, is about letting go of our habitual ways of thinking and being, to really explore this firsthand. And then I would say the third part is that we reflect as we go about our daily lives, mindfully observing our own behavior and thoughts and assumptions. And in particular, developing the capacity for mindfulness, like paying attention to something long enough that we notice it changes. So we notice the impermanence of things that we identify as self. My body must not be my inherently existing, enduring self, because it changes and it ages and it doesn't do what I ask it to do sometimes, and I'm eventually going to die, right? So that can't be self. my achievements, like my career, can't be it be my inherently existing self because I just lost my job, for example. So we see these things that we identify as self change, and it starts to make us question. But despite even seeing things be impermanent, we usually conclude, okay, well, that's not my inherently existing enduring self nature, but something else must be. I haven't found it yet. It's elusive, but I know it's in there. It must be somewhere else. We desperately want our self nature to be inherent, enduring, independent. This self nature is us. If I don't actually exist, that's terrifying or disorienting. We're convinced there's some elusive kernel of me-ness that has persisted throughout our life, present within us when we were a little child, when we were a teenager, when we were a young adult, middle-aged adult, an elder, some kernel of meanness. It's true, we've never been able to really grasp it, but you know, it's obvious that it's there. This I was, is, and will be the protagonist of my life journey. This I was, is, and will be the doer. This I was, is, and will be the experiencer of pleasure, pain, happiness, or misery. This I was, is, and will be the thinker, feeler, speaker, decision maker, performer. This I understands or does not understand. This I achieves or fails to achieve. This I is happy or unhappy. This I is loved or unloved. So this is just central to the way that our minds function. So I want to do a brief breakout and ask the question, well, so what? What's the problem with that? What's the problem with believing we have this I? In believing we have an inherent, enduring self-nature? And for the moment, just like set aside the question of whether we actually do. Just kind of set that aside. We don't have to argue about emptiness or not emptiness, what the self really is. But even if you kind of assume it's true and we have this inherent enduring self nature, kind of what are the implications of that? What are the repercussions of that? What does that mean? How does that cause problems for us? How does that cause us kind of distress or suffering, worry, whatever? All righty. And I will broadcast the question. let me see. All right. Well, I hope you had some animated discussion. So the you know, there's nothing wrong with the self in a conventional sense, right? There's definitely not saying anything like that. Like there's wrong with being a human being or wrong with having a journey, wrong with, you know, having interests or relationships or goals or anything like that. This is what we're talking about is more subtle. It's just a sense of I behind this stuff. And I guess what I was thinking about when I asked myself this question was that as long as there is a sense of like inherently existing executive I who is the doer, is the experiencer, then this I bears the credit and the blame, bears the credit for the past and for the future and anything good that, you know, is in the present, but also then will bear the blame for that. And in these, if the I, if that's the nature of the self, then the I of this moment is just a little fraction of this long narrative about our life. If that I has been present all along, this I is on a journey. And so this moment is just like just a little piece of that. And the experience of this moment is colored by the past and by the future, by the suffering or the potential suffering or potential happiness in the future. And this is just a moment. So this is just scratching the surface of repercussions. But basically, carrying around really believing in this sense of inherently existing, enduring, independent self nature is stressful. Because momentarily, even if things are great and we can take credit for how things are, then we're responsible for maintaining them that way in a world that is constantly changing, has a lot of challenges, trials and tribulations, unkind people, unfair situations. It's like, it's going to be stressful to keep up. So what if there is no inherent self to receive the credit or take the blame? What if there's no self as we usually conceive of it? What if there is no one in charge, even though it seems like there is? So, I mean, if you're anything like me, your first response, even if you might edit it because you think, oh, that's not the right answer. But my first response is like, how would we even function? How would we take responsibility? How would we guide our lives if there's no one in charge? Imagine I get this picture of like a robot with its power turned off and it's just like, if there's nobody home, you know, you'd be like lobotomized. But setting aside for a moment whether this executive I really exists or needs to exist or whatever, let's say it doesn't. What would this be like? Let's say we are able to keep operating. We're able to more or less just keep up our lives and our responsibilities and talking and relating and all of this without this sense of enduring self. We might discover that our ability to respond effectively in this moment arises spontaneously, free of any stories about who we are and what we're capable of, about what we should do. It arises spontaneously in response to our circumstances, based on and informed by what we have learned and who we have become. It arises without any need for anticipation. We might find that we're free from fear. In this moment, we can only do what we can do. Instead of identifying with the potential suffering or downfall of our future self, we recognize that future being can only do what they can do in the moment. They will respond as we are responding in this moment. They will do their best. That's not me. We might find that we're more attentive, objective, generous, compassionate, because we're not preoccupied with our sense of self. And even when experiencing discomfort or pain, we might find that we're able to reflect, how bad is it? Can I tolerate or survive this? And we may find that we have greater equanimity and resilience because we're free from regrets or catastrophizing. So the list of benefits from operating wholeheartedly, not stepping aside from our life, but operating, but somehow without a belief in an inherently existing self nature, goes on and on. As Hongzhi says, the whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. But to get back to that question, don't we need the self as we usually conceive of it? It must exist. How else would we think, make decisions, take responsibility, do spiritual practice, relate to other people? If there's no executive I mean, at best, I'd just lead a dissolute, aimless life, right? I couldn't make any plans. I'm just kind of in the moment. I'd just make some kind of response or decision. Or at worst, I'd be lobotomized. So fortunately, beautifully, miraculously, surprisingly, the answer to this question is no. You've been operating perfectly well your entire life, and it's only an illusion that your executive eye is in charge. As it's completely an illusion. This is disorienting, and it takes a while to get your mind around it. And actually, you can't get your mind around it. you can experience this reality, but it's not something you can ever get your mind around because your mind is built for telling stories about reality. And reality is not our stories. So we know Buddhists have been saying for millennia that there is, like, the self is empty of any inherent enduring self nature, that this you know, executive I is not the substantial, real, effective thing we think it is. But now, as I'm fond of mentioning, modern science is demonstrating that to be the case as well. So in Why Buddhism is True, Robert Wright talks about research that suggests that the decision to do something, to say something, manifests in our body and mind before, like, our conscious thought, I'm going to. So in other words, like, the, you know, hormones flow to your hand to go do something, and then a thought occurs in your conscious brain, like, I'm going to scratch my head. So it sure looks like this narrative self, this conscious self, it serves some kind of function, presumably, but not what we think. And one of the suggestions is that it basically just evolved so that we could make sense of things for ourselves and have a sense of agency and be able to communicate to other people as if, like, we're in control. I decided to scratch my head as opposed to, like, I don't know, something happened. I just found my hand on my head, you know, doesn't sound good. So so if this sense of executive I is a part of our human phenomenon, but it's not really central the way that we think. And we know this. I mean, even if that kind of research shows to, like, we're concluding the wrong things from it, how often do you consciously decide to do something but then fail to follow through? Almost as if your executive eye really isn't in charge. Are you able to control your own mind for more than a few seconds at a time? Even if you're remarkable in this regard, and in your deep meditation or even in your daily life, you can kind of control your mind most of the time. What, maybe 50%? I don't know that I've even met anybody who can control their mind like that for 50% of the time. What's happening the other 50%? And I think we've all experienced that, being in the flow, right? Being, doing something, participating in something in which there's no story about ourselves, there's no sense of separation from our activity. And when we're like that, actually things work better. like the executive eye being out of the way, actually everything functions not only just fine, but better. It's better when the executive eye is out of the way. So moment by moment practicing with emptiness of self, I feel like in any given situation, when we find ourselves experiencing dukkha, so this is stress, dis-ease, suffering, resistance, restriction, inhibition, anxiety, depression, we can look for our sense of inherently existing, enduring self-nature. And this is the way that our practice is done. We don't go looking for the true nature of self. The true nature of self is empty and not something that we can conceive of. What we can do is look for our assumption, look for our sense of I. That is something that we create. So that's something that we can find. So we look for that sense of I at the core of our experience. And then we just question it. We're not looking to like get rid of it, because that's too much of an agenda. We just observe it. We know it. We question it, follow it. And maybe if we develop some ability, we might be able to just like maybe just drop that for a moment and see what it's like, just kind of an experimental way. So we learn a great deal about our delusion. We study our delusion carefully, which is why Dogen says in Genjo Koan, those who totally realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are totally deluded about realization are ordinary people. So it's understanding this delusion that is actually liberation or awakening. So we shine the light of awareness on our belief in this I. So I just wanted to give an example. So I feel a sense of great stress, distress, fear, sadness, overwhelm when I contemplate the fact that it's been 2 years since the IPCC, the UN's incredibly conservative political body, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a report saying we have 12 years to decrease our greenhouse gas emissions by over 50% or face a global catastrophe of just unimaginable scale. 2 years later, so that was 2 years ago, 2 years later, we've done nothing, essentially nothing, and emissions are just still increasing very quickly. So you might conclude that this is an outside source of stress, and that my view of self doesn't really enter into whether it's upsetting or not. And it's true that our lives will be impacted by this situation, regardless of our senses of self or our spiritual practice or anything. But my experience of the situation, my ability to face it and respond to it, is profoundly affected by the state of my own body and mind. So this is the amazing message of Buddhism from the beginning. This is when the Buddha said, dang, man, humans seem to have a have a bad deal here. Like there's so much suffering and injustice and you name it. Is there anything we can do about it besides just kind of like, you know, luck of the draw? Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're fortunate, then we're going to lose it, whatever. Is there anything we can do about that? And he found out, yes. What our experience of the world, no matter what is going on, is profoundly affected by the state of our own mind. So when I feel stress and despair about the impending extinction of life on our planet, I am thinking, I was born on Earth at a time when we are about to destroy ourselves. I have ignored this problem, contributed to it, thought about it, formed opinions about it, tried to help address it. I am struggling to find an effective way to stop our trajectory towards self-destruction. I sometimes achieve what I set out to do, sometimes I fail. I am watching the breakdown of our planet's natural life support systems, and I experience great grief and despair about it. So there's a utility to these stories. They're my mind making sense of my experience and putting it in terms that I can express to you. So what does it mean in this example for me to look for my belief in inherently existing self-nature? So I want to start by saying what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that everything's in my imagination. It doesn't mean that if I do some special mental gymnastics, climate change isn't really happening, or I don't really care about it. That's turning emptiness into a story. What practicing with the emptiness of self in this example does mean is recognizing that there's actually no protagonist in this drama. The drama unfolds, and ultimately, the only reality is this being experiencing and responding to this moment. This moment's I is not just a fraction of the overarching narrative of my life. This moment's I is actually all there is. This moment's I exists in a certain place, in a flow of causes and conditions. How this moment's I functions is influenced by infinite choices I've made in the past, and what I choose to do conditions what will unfold in the future. There's no one to blame, no one who must find a way. There's no one in charge. And if that sounds terrifying or disorienting, or it's because you don't yet understand what it really means. It's not terrifying, it's liberating. So despite my undeniable experience of all the stress and grief around the climate emergency, in this moment, I breathe. In this moment, the sun filters through the leaves outside my window. In this moment, my heart is full of love for this planet and its beautiful and amazing manifestations of life. In this moment, my compassion fills me with great determination to help. In this moment, a leap into the unknown next moment feels like the greatest intimacy. So there's a Chan teaching poem, Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage by Sherto, that is about this kind of thing, about the emptiness of self and how still we manage to function anyway, and actually it's liberating. So it ends with these verses. Open your hands and walk, innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. That undying person is the hut, in the hut, is the one who actually is behind our lives. But we can't go looking for them. We let them manifest our lives. So leave it there. Any comments or questions? Let's go ahead and unmute yourself if you have anything to say. Domio,
I just wanted to say, in the breakout group I just had, you have just explained everything that happened. I can't take all the time here today, but you explained everything that happened to me when I took a cross-country trip on the train 4.5 days to Toronto and then 4.5 days back. I was visiting my aunt who has dementia. And I was telling the breakout group that it was a last minute thing. I had 24 hours to decide on which train, what the schedule was, find a room, the buses and the trains. And what you described, I was trying to tell them that I had no fear. I wasn't, it's about living in the moment. And I took each step. I mean, being alone on a train, and you have no idea, four days of it, and da-da-da-da-da on the train, and the nights. But the whole experience was somewhat of what you described. I think it happened to me just because of the meditation and the Buddhist practice that made me be in the now, as you described. You just talked about it just exactly the way it happened. So thank you.
Dilmio, yeah. Would it be possible if you read the verse from the Tron again? It seemed to me it was really rather short.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the end of it.
Right.
Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now.
Thank you.
Kind of like these moments of quiet reflection. Yesterday at the one day retreat, when we were checking out, James, who participates with us, said he does online trainings, and he said his students observed that when he has in a situation like this and he's asking for responses, they said, "You wait longer than anybody else that we've ever encountered." And he realized, like, yeah, I gotta learn that from participating at the Zen Center, where we just kind of go, "All right, here we are."
The self starts getting agitated.
In the silence?
Yeah.
I like to think of it as just, we're all kind of just being silent and letting the, and absorbing the Dharma together.
No, yeah, I agree with that, Domyo. But I think what happens is that, to varying degrees, participants in the silence have maybe a tolerance or a limit for it, and then it begins to agitate.
Well, if you get agitated, you can always just log off.
That's right. Bye-bye. Goodbye. Oh, here's a good thing. Here's a funny thing. Paulette said, well, if we just, you know, don't have any self, then pretty soon it's just going to be a big blob of humanity. And I said, maybe that's called suchness blob.
What Bob just said actually reminded me of a conversation I had many, many years ago when I was in grad school. And I forget what the context of this. It was, we were reading, if anyone's ever had to read Michel Foucault before, you know, 20th century philosopher, big, big wig dude. We were reading one of his really intense books on human sexuality and interaction. I don't know. It was weird. But I remember walking out of the room and one of my friends turned to me and said, so do you really think we're just like all amoeba, like rubbing up against each other and that's that? And I just remember kind of looking at her and being like, what's wrong with that? And I'm like, I don't know. It was just, you know, that immediate direct response between each other and our environment. And that seems to be the time when we seem to be like kind of most ourselves. And like, I kind of, what I was thinking about in the silence is kind of a, I don't know if I've ever shared this story before. It's really a strange story and kind of fits in with Domio's robot thing. But I was cooking with my mom once many, many years ago, and she had a pot holder on her hand and she reached across the gas burner. And so of course the pot holder went up in flames while it was on, while she was working the grill. And I just turned to her and my dad was standing there and in like the most monotone, non-emotional voice ever, I was just like, Mom, your hand is on fire. And that was, I didn't panic. I didn't like flip out, like nothing. I just, your hand's on fire. And that was like that. And it was really, but it was just like, that was the response to that situation. Like, by the way, did you know you're on fire right now? You might want to do something about that. Like, and then she freaked out, you know, but it was just really strange. Like that was just, I was just responding to the environment at the time. There was no fear. There was no worry. There was no thought about, you know, the future and the fact that she was going to end up in the emergency room. She was fine. But, you know, like, is that really so bad? Like, is it really so bad when we can just naturally be and respond to what's directly mm-hmm. before us? I don't know.
I like it. All right. Well, in the interest of letting you all get off on your day, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. All right, have a good day.
Hey, Domio.
Thanks, everyone.
Domio. Thanks yeah. for sharing that story. It was good, Sydney.
Yeah, Bob.
One more thing. I had a vision of a cartoon where there's a whole bunch of amoebas in the panel, and one of them has a thought balloon saying, I am I. And there's another one saying, yeah, that amoeba is suffering. Sorry.
I like it. Leave us with that for the day.
Okay. Bye-bye.